Good morning again, and happy President's Day, or almost. I wish you well, and hope that those of you who have the 9-to-5 type schedules enjoy your day off tomorrow. Most of you will have. And I want to begin today by doing just a little President's Day quiz, just for fun. So get your thinking caps on, and we have a little bit of quick but well-known thinking music for you to think. Get ready. All right, ready? Time is up. Okay, we're not going to do this in the answer question format, though, thankfully. Okay, most presidents of the past identified in one way or another as Christian. What is your guess as to the most common denomination that those people were drawn from? Episcopalian, there you go. And that would make perfect sense because Episcopalianism is the American branch of the Anglican Communion, otherwise known as the Church of England. So that would have been the first direct connection from the British to the American colonies. Second most? Presbyterian. Wow, Barbara. All right. Who's got the score sheet up here? All right, great. Name two Baptists. There were four total. Jimmy Carter. Bill Clinton, along with Harry Truman and Warren G. Harding. How many Catholics have been president of the U.S.? We all know who that was. Okay. I thought I could fool you. Like, oh, maybe there's more than one. Nope. Okay, you're clear. The lone Congregationalist. Not Jefferson. Now, just to clarify, here's a bonus question. Does anybody know what the Congregationalists are now known as? The United Church of Christ, or UCC, which is probably the most liberal Christian denomination, very akin to Unitarianism. Actually, it's also known, UCC is also known as Unitarians Considering Christianity. So, and that lone Congregationalist was Calvin Coolidge. Two Dutch Reform presidents. Van Buren, wow, who came up with that one? Wow, that was terrific. First name? Martin, yep, I had to look that one up, so great. And the eighth, who was our eighth president, and the second in our program today, Teddy Roosevelt, was a Dutch Reform person. Two Quakers. Nixon, there you go, right? Who should have, you know, he was actually very active in his church in Yorba Linda, California, growing up. He probably, as president, should have gone to a few more friends meetings. The other was Herbert Hoover. Okay, yes. Before we get to the Unitarians, who was known as, in his time, as the preacher president? Not formally a minister, but he became a Christian in 1850 and preached the gospel until he became a member of Congress in 1863. James Garfield. Okay, and now on to our famous Unitarians. Four of them. John Quincy Adams. Not on this list. We'll talk about that. Millard Fillmore, right. Absolutely. Wow. John Q. Adams, John Adams, and William H. Taft. Bonus question. Taft served both as the president, the 27th president from 1909 to 1913, and is distinguished as the only person to have held both the office of president and of Supreme Court Chief Justice. That's right. So, finally, who were the two with no formal religious affiliation? Thomas Jefferson, influenced by Unitarianism and by deism, and Abraham Lincoln. So, thank you for playing. Who had right answers? Just, okay. It doesn't really matter. Just so you know, for each correct answer, you're entitled to put an extra $20 in the collection basket today. The treasurer is clapping. That was the loan clap, was from the treasurer, yes. Thank you, Barbara. Okay, going a little deeper now into our topic of who we might consider the most spiritual presidents in our national history and how their spirituality affected them as national leaders. First, I want to say that having a rich spiritual life can be very different from claiming a religious affiliation. And in that light, I've chosen to focus on three figures: Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, both of which we just mentioned did not claim an official connection with a church body, and Theodore Roosevelt. And I find it very interesting that both Lincoln and Jefferson were really religious free thinkers, as are Unitarians, and claim no formal affiliation, and yet are perhaps our most revered presidents. So it's really interesting that that personal sense of spirituality really came out in a big way through them. So also, just so you can kind of ration your listening energy today, I'm going to spend a little time on Jefferson, a little less on Lincoln, and wrap up fairly quickly with Roosevelt. So to begin with Thomas Jefferson, his driving mission and eternal legacy was the defense of individual liberty. In 1776, he wrote the Declaration of Independence, and the next year, convinced that the state should not mandate religious conformity, introduced a, quote, bill concerning religious freedom, unquote, to the Virginia legislature. In 1787, he urged James Madison to amend the Constitution to guarantee religious liberty. Now, Jefferson's actions fueled criticism, as they might today, of his personal religious beliefs, and this emerged as a critical issue in the presidential race of 1800 when his Federalist opponents maligned him as an atheist. Jefferson seethed at the persecution from what he termed an irritable tribe of priests and was elected over John Adams. 2 years later, on New Year's Day in 1802, he entertained at the White House a dissident Baptist preacher named John Leland. And that same day, he replied to a letter from Baptists in Danbury, Connecticut, who were struggling and protesting the authority of the established state congregational church. And in his reply, Jefferson invoked the now famous, quote, wall of separation between church and state, which, of course, has become a pillar of American politics. Until now, Barbara says. Like most other founding fathers, Jefferson was considered a deist, a liberal religious philosophy that values reason over revelation and rejects traditional Christian doctrines, including original sin and the virgin birth and resurrection of Jesus. But Jefferson was also influenced quite a bit by Unitarianism, which was ascending in New England at the Revolutionary times. The difference between Unitarianism and deism mostly concerned the question of how much God intervened in history. The Unitarians of the time said, not much, and the deists said, not at all. And in part through his relationship with British Unitarian Joseph Priestley, Jefferson became convinced that Jesus' message had been misinterpreted and corrupted by the gospel writers, by the Apostle Paul, and by Protestant reformers. So while president, he took a scissors to the Bible. The resulting volume, The Philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth, affirmed Jefferson's Unitarian conviction that Jesus was not divine, but rather, quote, a teacher of common sense, mainly concerned with morality and ethical conduct. Years later, Jefferson continued this work by drawing from the New Testaments in Greek, Latin, French, and English to create, quote, the life and morals of Jesus, commonly known as the Jefferson Bible. Afterward, he told a friend that he was, quote, a real Christian, that is to say, a disciple of the doctrines of Jesus. And in a letter written later in life, he declared that if there were a Unitarian church in Virginia, that he would be a member. Of course, today we cannot mention Jefferson, unfortunately, without noting the colossal blind spot in his defense of liberty and his spiritual awareness, namely his status as a slaveholder. Which brings us to our second, quote, spiritual president with no formal religious affiliation, Abraham Lincoln. Born to a Kentucky frontiersman and his wife, Abraham Lincoln was raised a Baptist, where religious zeal mixed with severe Calvinism, the belief that every man's fate is determined by God. Lincoln rejected both this theology and the evangelical excesses of his youth, But Calvinism marked him somewhat with a persistent sense of fatalism. He was known to be a borderline depressive at some times, and this may have had an influence on that. And when I say depressive, he was not debilitated, but he felt deeply the pathos of his time. And of course, that pathos was huge, as we know, during that period of our history. In fact, the Civil War led Lincoln to undergo a profound spiritual journey. Before it, like the deists, he imagined God as a distant machine-like force. And he wrote, "Man is simply a simple tool, a mere cog in the wheel, a part, a small part of this vast iron machine that strikes and cuts, grinds and mashes all things, including man, that resist it." But as the horrible toll of war grew, he began to view divinity as more personal, a mysterious presence that was active in human affairs, yet whose purpose eluded human understanding. In September 1862, Lincoln committed his thoughts about God on a small piece of paper, which his secretary later entitled "Meditation on the Divine Will." Here's an abridged excerpt. "In great contests," he said, speaking of the war, "each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God. Both may be, and one must be, wrong. God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time. Yet the contest proceeds." That same month of September 1862, Union forces drove the Confederates from Antietam Creek in Maryland. The president called his cabinet together and said that this victory was a divine signal for him to issue a proclamation abolishing slavery in the rebel states. God, Lincoln declared, had decided this question in favor of the slaves. This pronouncement of God's will was so astonishing to his cabinet that one member asked Lincoln to repeat himself because he was sure that he had not heard right. But he had. Lincoln had endowed the Civil War with sacred purpose. And on New Year's Day, 1863, he signed the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing slaves in the Confederacy. When the war ended and Lincoln won re-election, 30,000 people gathered at the Capitol expecting to hear him celebrate a great victory for the North, one they felt had been guided by God. But the war had been too brutal, and God's intentions too uncertain in Lincoln's mind for Lincoln to feel triumphant. Instead, he wrote with typical empathy and humility, "Neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. The prayers of both could not be answered. That is, that of neither has been fully answered. The Almighty has his own purposes." Of course, we know that Lincoln himself became a casualty of the conflict. Shot on Good Friday in April 1865, he died the day before Easter Sunday. Some ministers privately lamented that Lincoln had never formally joined a church, yet he had just become one of America's most theologically and spiritually divine or thoughtful presence about the divine in life. And finally, while we might not normally think so, Theodore Roosevelt, who served as president from 1901 to 1909, was also a very spiritually thoughtful man. He joined the Dutch Reformed Church as a teenager in New York and wrote of his beliefs, "I know not how philosophers may ultimately define religion, but from Micah to James," referring to books of the Bible, "it has been defined as service to one's fellow men, rendered by following the great rule of justice and mercy, of wisdom and righteousness." As president, Roosevelt applied this ethic to domestic and national policy as well as to foreign policy. Quote, "We must demand honesty, justice, mercy, truthfulness in our dealings with one another within our own borders. Outside of our own borders, we must treat other nations as we would wish to be treated in return, judging each in any given crisis as we ourselves ought to be judged." I suggest there are some lessons today that our politicians might heed in this statement. But here I want to briefly focus, lastly, on Roosevelt's connection with famed naturalist John Muir. Roosevelt had sent Muir a letter asking to meet him in Yosemite, writing, "I want to drop politics absolutely for 4 days and just be out in the open with you." And in his autobiography, Roosevelt described the start of their adventure. "When I first visited California, it was my good fortune to see the big trees, the sequoias, and then to travel down into the Yosemite with John Muir. Of course, of all people in the world, he was the one with whom it was best to see Yosemite. John Muir met me with a couple of packers and two mules to carry our tent, bedding, and food for a 3-day trip. The first night was clear, and we lay down in the darkening aisles of the great sequoia grove. The majestic trunks, beautiful in color and in symmetry, rose around us like the pillars of a mightier cathedral than ever was conceived, even by the fervor of the Middle Ages." So there Roosevelt reveals this connection, this inner connection between his awareness and the mighty cathedrals of formalized religion. During their outing, John Muir spoke of environmental degradation and asked that Yosemite be granted another layer of protection as a national park. Muir convinced both Roosevelt and California Governor George Pardee, who was also along on part of that excursion, to make the valley and the Mariposa Grove of sequoias part of Yosemite National Park. Muir helped Roosevelt to take the long view, which to me can be seen as spiritual wisdom. And Roosevelt got it. He wrote, "There can be nothing in the world more beautiful than the Yosemite, the groves of the giant sequoias. Our people should see to it that they are preserved for their children and their children's children forever, with their majestic beauty all unharmed." As a result, during his presidency, Theodore Roosevelt signed into existence 5 national parks, 18 national monuments, 55 national bird sanctuaries and wildlife refuges, and 150 national forests. And any one of us who has ever reveled in the splendor of any of these has, among others, Roosevelt and Muir to thank. So in closing, I just want to point out one commonality between all of these 3 former presidents. And I'll preface this with a quote from the great philosopher Immanuel Kant. "For peace to reign on earth," wrote Kant, "humans must evolve into new beings who have learned to see the whole first." For peace to reign on earth, humans must evolve into new beings who have learned to see the whole first. In sharp contrast to the limited, sometimes polarizing views and policies of some contemporary politicians, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Roosevelt were statesmen. Statesmen who saw the whole and sought to govern from that enlightened awareness. Jefferson in stating that all people are created equal, Lincoln in preserving the Union and ending slavery, and Roosevelt, partly through Muir, in leaving a legacy of irreplaceable natural treasures for future generations. And as the interdependent web of existence that's affirmed by our 7th UU principle becomes more and more apparent, both socially and environmentally in our shrinking planet, now more than ever, we need to keep this ethic front and center in our decision-making. So as Unitarian Universalists, I ask you to consider this as a basic criterion as you decide what leaders and policies you will support. Of course, the details of human affairs are complex. But at root, we might ask ourselves, is this person or proposal more concerned with privileging a particular subgroup or seeking to serve the whole? If you ask this simple question of yourself, if you act accordingly, and if you demand that your leaders act accordingly, I have no doubt that Tom, Abe, and Teddy would be immensely grateful and proud. Amen and blessed be.